Thank you, Richard. Our next speaker completed his graduate studies at Yale University, where he took his PhD. He's presently an associate professor of political science at Colgate University, where he teaches political theory. Many of you will recognize him as the author of The Myth of American Individualism, The Protestant Origins of American Political Thought, published by Princeton University a few years ago, a very important book, and only one of many of his publications. His topic today is liberalism and our Protestant origins. Would you please welcome Professor Barry Allen Shane.
This is an unusual opportunity, and I'm very flattered by the chance to speak to this body. But I'm not going to flatter you. I want to challenge you. This is an opportunity which I've looked forward to, and one which I want to take advantage of. It seems to me the conservatives have been wrong in two issues in regard to the founding. One, most importantly, is the reverence and the sort of esteem that we award to the founders, or that which we describe as the founders. In my mind, there seems to be almost an incoherence and even certain kind of self-deprecation in conservatives showing that kind of admiration for the people in the American colonies and then soon to be the American nation who are the most progressive, the most liberal, the most enlightened, the most hostile to any understanding that we might give to the word conservative. How can it be that American conservatives, quote-unquote conservatives, sit in admiration at the feet of the men who are the most progressive, the most liberal? It's almost as if Lawrence Tribe and Dworkin were to be our heroes. And yet most of you would find that remarkably odd or strange. What I want to urge instead is that we find not the American founders, and meaning what we usually mean by that is this group of national elitists, national liberals, enlightened classical liberals of the 1770s and 80s as the men to whom we turn for some sort of guidance, but instead we turn to the founding, a long experience starting in 1630, maybe going up to 1780, which has its vision, that of a Christian localism, that is the vision which we as conservatives should turn to for guidance, for understanding, for inspiration, and that is the founding, that is the moment, that is the American vision from which we can learn, and more importantly, from which we can build. It seems to me that it's impossible to imagine how, as conservatives, we can build on the inheritance of the most progressive liberal men of the time. Instead, what I'd urge is turning away from the enlightened liberalism, the moderate enlightened liberalism. These men are not Diderot, they're not Condorcet, they're not Condillac, but they are enlightenment men turning away from the hallowed wisdom of ages, turning away from religion, turning away from morality, and turning it away from at least as a public sphere. We cannot continue, as conservatives or Americans, turning to them for resources. They're too thin, they're too anemic, and they're in fact dangerous. But yet as conservatives, as last night's speaker introduced to us, I was told once again how wonderful the founders are. I want to urge that we reconsider, that we turn instead to our Christian localist roots for our inspiration. And in this sense, I think it's very important that it may have been at an earlier time sensible to turn to the founders meaning in this sense, the classical liberals, for some sort of inspiration. At that time, there was a sort of, we were bare of alternative visions. But I think that recent historiography, as was also pointed out last night, has changed that character of our possibilities. We now have access to a new history, another history, a richer history, one which draws attention to a different America, an America which still resonates with the aspirations of many Americans still living today, and one which is far more inherently conservative, one which has far deeper roots in the soil of our psyche, and one which we can build on. And again, that's the wonder of the Christian localism. Americans at the founding, not the five or six men to whom we turn with such regularity for inspiration on how to be progressive liberals, but the Americans living in 1770, the vast majority of them were Reformed, Protestant, communal, and localist, that thought it was essential to, for a good life that a human being be living in a morally intrusive community that shared a common moral vision. That is not the vision of the nationalist elite, the liberal, progressive liberals like Madison, to whom most of us turn, or too often turn, for guidance. It seems to me that it's not surprising that people like Louis Hart say to American conservatives that American conservatism is un-American. It seems to me that too many conservatives would seem to add evidence to that as they turn away from our conservative inheritance and instead turn to our liberal inheritance as somehow or other conservative. I think the odd fact is that truly conservatives, truly conservatives are on the right side of our history, and more ironically and unexpectedly, we are on the right side of our future, but only if we add to our liberal inheritance a richer, deeper Christian localist inheritance. This is what I find ironic, or at least unexpected, is that it is the case, I believe, that our Christian localist roots actually can live well with a diverse America. I say this as a Jewish American. I'm not Christian. I'm not a Christian from a small town. I'm from Beverly Hills. Which should give you some idea of my bona fides when I talk about degeneracy and moral decadence. But it's my impression that this other vision, a vision of Christian localism, is one that actually could live well even with Americans who are not Christian, even with Americans who may not aspire to the Christian localist vision. Localism has the beauty, it has the feature of allowing small groups of people committed to diverse moral visions to live out their lives in pursuit of that. It doesn't have the arrogance, the hubris of the liberal vision, which is to impose on all people the same moral understanding, which as we see crumbling around us, we should start beginning to wonder how wonderful this project is and how much we can rest upon it. It seems to me that the founders of liberalism is most importantly at odds with traditional conservatism on critical issues, most particularly the role of morality and religion in our lives. It does not demand further comment, I think, for us to recognize this. But such differences do suggest that if given a viable alternative, conservatives should be interested in relinquishing some of their allegiance to classical liberalism. Surely the fact that classical liberalism is not able to confront alone many of the intellectual challenges that our contemporary world presents should be of great importance to those not committed to conservatism. To us, it should be even more powerful. Because of its lack of a defensible secular foundation, its Enlightenment's hubris, its lowering of man's deepest aspirations, its rather heroic view of man as self-legislating, and its insistence on the privatization of moral and religious matters, it can do little to offset a continuing erosion in contemporary morality. What can liberals say to 80% of African Americans who choose to have their children out of wedlock? What can liberalism say to the 1.5 million babies which are aborted in this year by professional women who find them inconvenient? My answer, nothing. But I think that with the realization that our political inheritance, both conceptual and institutional, is at its historical core, Christian communal, should add greatly to the resources, intellectual and otherwise, that we can use to confront the continuing decline in the moral life of America. Oddly enough, this historiography, which I think we can do so much to exploit and to use in constructing an American conservatism which is viable for today for all Americans, did not come as a result of conservative intellectual activity as much as it came as a result of an American historiography. an historiography which discovered a different America than which was simply promulgated in our textbooks. And it wasn't just simply the product of conservatives, it was a product of a debate between two sides, one generally adhering to and acting as apologists for a hard-to-imagine and ill-conceived, timeless Lockean liberalism, and another side of, again, a hard-to-conceive and timeless classical republicanism. But out of this debate came a new historiography, a vision of America as Christian, America that's Christian, communal, and localist. Many of the people here in this conference have done so much to make this possible, have exposed these roots, have exposed this history. I have in mind Jim McClellan, Stanton Evans, Forrest MacDonald, and then others who I think are not here, Daniel Elazar, Donald Lutz, Marvin Alasky, Paul Johnson, all have pushed for us to recognize that we have a different inheritance, not the classical liberalism solely, of the founders, of the so-called founders, but of the founding, a moment of Christian localism which was the political vision, which guided, was the conceptual frameworks, and in many instances, as Lutz and MacDonald have so pointed out, is the institutional framework from which our American institutions actually arose. They too were Christian. Americans then in the late 18th century were not a people who, as some scholars friendly to conservatism have contended, founded colonies and then a nation, quote, around a pervasive, indeed almost monolithic commitment to classical liberal ideas, end quote. Yet in contrast as well to the historians who are part of the Republican moment, if you will, in America, is that America was not a people who were anthropocentric and believed that their good was independent of a Christian faith and an omniscient God. Not altogether surprising to those acquainted with today's small-town America, 18th century Americans were parochial, reformed Protestant peoples whose thought was strikingly dependent on a Christian origin. Unlike the idealized Machiavellian urban republic citizens sought by people like Hannah Arendt, or the privatistic Lockean liberals of Louis Hartz, most Americans were interested in their communities, their families, local agricultural matters, and acquiring Christ's freely given grace, and they were not interested in particular in personal development through Bruce Ackerman's participatory politics or the sanctification of individual autonomy. Late 18th century Americans, thus, were neither a noble nor heroic people in the classical or Renaissance Republican caste, nor an avaricious, individualistic one in the classical liberal mold. The vast majority lived voluntarily and morally demanding, and let me repeat, morally demanding, because this is what I think we need and which we must take from our forefathers. Morally demanding reformed Protestant agricultural communities. These villages were defined by overlapping circles of community-sponsored and assisted self-regulation and even self-denial, rather than by individual autonomy or political self-expression. For them, the public's needs were to be awarded preeminence over the immediate ones of discrete individuals. And although this is a value that Madisonian liberalism also shares, it has proved incapable of protecting this priority against the attack of contemporary liberals. Instead, for the needed intellectual resources which to confront this problem, we must turn to our preponderantly Christian moral foundations as embodied in the lives of 18th century rural farmers and much of even the intelligentsia, but not that which is on the radar screen of most those who seek to find sources of inspiration in the so-called founders. These people drop below that radar. It is not then the enlightened liberals of America's most visible elite that we must turn for guidance. In opposition to liberalism, classical and contemporary, most Americans held that the autonomous self, that combination of wants and passions that came to replace the soul as the essential core of man in modern secular thought, was instead the center of our sinfulness. This estrangement from God's love was well reflected in man's selfishness, an aspect of his being that was deplored by most 18th century Americans, but which came to be promoted by the elite's embrace of classical liberalism. But for our Christian forebears, as is still true for many conservatives, the autonomous self is neither an ultimate ethical category nor the center of moral worth. More telling still is that when liberty, the most important of 18th century American political concepts, is examined, one finds that revolutionary-era Americans believe that in all but one of its various forms, it characterized a voluntary submission to a life of righteousness, not license, righteousness. This righteousness accorded with a universal moral standard and was mediated by divine revelation and the authoritative interpretive capacity of congregation and community. This was not the language of Madisonian liberalism. This was not the language of classical liberalism. This was the language of a Christian localist people who believed in and were inspired by revelation. An examination of liberty also invites an exploration of the critical role played by original sin in how 18th century Americans understood liberty, and by extension their political thought and that of their forebears. In its powerful presence in their thought and the certainty it provided regarding man's innate and egotistical character circumscribed throughout the 18th century and beyond the range of social and political possibilities that Americans could embrace. In fact, it seems to me that probably the most important belief of 18th century Americans was that in original sin. It shaped their political vision, their horizons, in a way which seems to have no end. Thus, we must remember that whether early Americans attended formal religious services more or less often than today, and there is good evidence that they may have attended less. They read the Bible as an authoritative source of morality and used as their elementary school primer the Westminster Shorter Catechism of Reformed Doctrines. America was a land in which the dominant language and pattern of social political thought, clearly to me, was Reformed Protestant. Nothing, I think, demonstrates this better than the revolutionaries' commitment to such a Christian understanding as the Continental Congress's numerous, I think there's 18, national proclamation for days of public humiliation, fasting, and prayers, so that Americans could, with united hearts and voices, unafraidly confess and deplore their sins. As Miller explained, other public documents, such as the celebrated Declaration, were written to appeal to European audiences and thus use the Enlightenment language of social compact and inalienable rights. The fast proclamations, however, spoke, quote, to the ranks of militia and citizens, end quote, who were fighting the war, and accordingly spoke of spiritual purges, sin, contrition and humiliation, and God's blessing for his repentant children. In these proclamations, Americans were requested to repair to their Protestant houses of worship in, quote, penitent confession of their manifold sins, end quote, and implore, quote, in humble and earnest supplication that it may please God through the merits of Jesus Christ mercifully to forgive and blot them out, end quote. They were do so in order to spread, quote, the means of religion for the promotion and enlargement of that kingdom which consisteth in righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Ghost, end quote. This is not the language of individualism. It's not the language of classical liberalism. And for those who think that American national statements never mention God, never mention Christ, never mention the Holy Spirit, I suggest they reread their original documents. In sum, a defense of classical liberalism as America's political thought of origin is inadequate, not only because it falsely reifies contemporary liberal individualism into America's chosen political ideology and errantly elevates the progressive liberalism of the founders over the Christian localism of the founding, but because it detracts from this long, though not fully developed, tradition of American conservative thought. American history has been constantly revised so that it appears that this conservative political vision with its self-overcoming intentions never existed, or that as a people we gladly and willingly relinquished it for more individualistic alternatives. In truth, though, I believe, we know that America's Christian communal localism is our oldest and most enduring political tradition. One might still ask, though, even if Protestant communalism was the guiding vision of revolutionary-era Americans and that which shaped the origins of many of our political institutions, what does it have to say about our constitutional regime, and even more importantly, what does it have to say of relevance to us today? Surely if Americans' Protestant communal inheritance is to serve as the foundation for contemporary conservatism, as I think it must and can, these questions must, however, be answered. In regard to our inherited federal regime, there is little in American Christian communalism that is out of sync with it. The elasticity of the Constitution allows it to accommodate today's centralizing liberal nationalists as well as its original federalism to which American conservatives rightly seek to return. In this instance, we should support what Madison defended rather than what he sought. Moreover, much of what he helped put in place deserves our continued praise. The federal institutional structure, with its protection against the abuse of power and national tyranny, and its encouragement of a sound and prosperous free market economy, indeed make possible the intimate communities of moral discourse which I am urging. Viewed more broadly, a conservatism derived from Protestant foundations still has much to recommend it. Most importantly, its emphasis on localism, or couched in the language of Catholic social thought, subsidiarity, make possible a wide range of varying social and political arrangements based on intrusive moralities, not the neutrality of liberalism, but the intrusive moralities of a people committed to a moral end. As I noted earlier, not all Americans need, therefore, be moved by the claims of Protestant Christianity for them to live under a tolerant regime shaped by a conservative philosophy of government that draws on Protestant origins. Without adhering to any particular theology, they will profit from adherence to a worldview committed to localism, communalism, and religious-based morality. Even some captured by the tides of postmodern skepticism might find this an attractive alternative to the centralizing dogmatism of a collapsing liberalism. And for those parts of the nation which believe in Christians still predominate, all human life with coherence can again be viewed as sharing in God's sanctification and thus no longer subject to the killing fields of Americans' liberal self-indulgence. Conservatives have good reason, then, to embrace, in addition to classical liberalism, a political philosophy that does not demand that individuals fashion moral lives on their own from the anemic resources provided by Kantianism. As James Q. Wilson has reminded us, we can choose to live in the shadow of two cities, Athens or Jerusalem, and as he points out, most of us need Jerusalem. Such an addition to liberalism does exist, one that is authentically American, truly conservative, and that can offer essential resources to the moderation of classical liberalism with which to help arrest America's ever-increasing moral decline. We've discovered in our history the foundation for such a conservative philosophy, one that is derived from our Protestant origins. Thus, in our history and in our contemporary politics, classical liberalism must share pride of place with America's local communalism, and yet it is, I think, probably from some sort of mixture of both that a fully contemporary American conservatism that can speak both to our national and our local needs is likely to emerge. In sum, what I urge is that we turn away from the founders, the five or six Enlightenment liberal progressives, which our history has somehow risen to the level of saints, and instead turn to our founding, the Christian localism which guided us in our revolution and which provided the ground for our continued moral success and will continue to guide us if we only turn to it.